Thank you, Dr. Nash. Welcome to Dallas, everyone. I'm now officially a Dallasite. We just moved into our apartment last week, my wife Beth and I. And I still spend time in Washington, but it's very invigorating to be in a city like Dallas, I can tell you. And congratulations to the Philadelphia Society for this conference and for the important work that you've been doing since 1964. I want to acknowledge a few people in the audience. First, Ed Fulner, my shining ideal as a think tank president. And I think it's safe to say that Ed has done more in the last 20 years to advance the cause of conservatism than I think any person in America. Thank you, Ed. And Wick Allison, bon vivant, and publisher and trendsetter and tastesetter here in Dallas, a man who has published political magazines as well as lifestyle magazines, and I think there's something related between those things. And many others, John Goodman, Dan Oliver, David Keene, great to see you all here. I'd like to talk today about conservatism and progressivism, and then relate my comments to our work at the Bush Institute. And I'm going to make three points. First, about the movement to freedom in the Middle East and North Africa. Second, the power of progressivism today. And third, about solving problems without government. First, the events today that are likely to have the most impact on America in the next few years may not be occurring here in the United States at all, but in the Middle East and North Africa. They are unexpected, and no one knows how they're going to turn out, but they are exhilarating, they are necessary, and they are right. Conservatives are often suspicious of romantic views of liberty. After all, the great Burkean conservative impulse came, quite rightly, in response to the French Revolution. But to be encouraged and to be thrilled by what is happening in places like Egypt is not romantic. Let me explain. It was Locke who said that man is born free, and he is born just as he is born rational. And as my boss, President Bush, likes to put it, freedom is universal. It applies to Americans and it applies to Muslims. And Rousseau, I figure assorted boos at the name of Rousseau, whatever you may think of him, said a century after Locke that while man is born free, he's everywhere in chains. And he is. Not everywhere, but those chains continue to bind. And while we are most concerned about our own chains, such as Obamacare, whatever that will turn out to be, the chains of others matter. And like Locke and Rousseau, the founders took liberty as an unalienable right and said the governments are formed to secure these rights. And this, to me, is the essence of conservatism. Government as conservator, as guardian, as steward of rights. In a sense, conservatism is necessary for liberalism, for classical liberalism. You have to have it. And this mission of conservatism, securing rights, is not passive. It's not even defensive. And I think that Chesterton actually had it right. It's often too passive and too defensive. It is active, and it is imaginative. And as Hayek has shown us in Why I Am Not a Conservative years ago, and something I'm going to get back to in a second. So if conserving unalienable rights is the reason, the only reason, that governments are formed, then preserving personal security is a prime, probably the prime, function of government. And when I was in the Bush administration, our national security policy was very clear, as some believe it is not today, but we had two aims. One was keeping America safe, and the other was promoting freedom abroad. And those two aims are linked. Free people tend not to make war on their neighbors or on anyone else for the very simple reason that, left to their own devices, people choose serenity and not adventurism abroad. But we should also not shy away from promoting and encouraging freedom as a moral good, as the great project of our time at home and abroad. Next, let me turn to the problem of progressivism today. Progressivism is a movement that emerged for good reasons at the turn of the century to essentially to clean up government originally. Ironically, it ended up making government dirtier by making it more pervasive. The ICC, the FTC, the FDA, antitrust, farm subsidies, and on came out of the progressive era, and they have thwarted progress and prosperity for the simple reason that they are based on a profound myth, which is that men in government can gather all the information and apply all the reasons to solve all the problems. This is the technocratic way that we see today on the right and on the left, from Newt Gingrich to Barack Obama. Progressivism is rooted in a deep distrust, even I would say a hatred, of politics and markets as discovery mechanisms. George Will, in a column last year, I'm sure you saw it, titled "Obama in the Wilsonian Tradition," quoted President Obama during the debate on healthcare as saying this: "I would have loved to come up with some very elegant, academically approved approaches to healthcare," said President Obama, "but that's not how it works in our democracy," he said lamentably. The operative words here are very elegant and academically approved solutions. But he should not fret. Today, we have achieved much of the progressive ideal. Professor Nash has written that about a potentially unlimited government guided by bureaucrats and experts increasingly insulated from popular consent. I think his words just before I came on were even stronger, even more vivid than that. But he's absolutely right. And in some ways, it's even worse today for four reasons. First, the ideology of progressivism has become so powerful that it is our instinctual response to almost any problem, almost any crisis. While Harding and Coolidge responded to the very severe 1921 to 1923 recession, a terrible recession, worse than 2008-2009, by rapidly cutting government, that was their response, our instinct is the opposite. Second, government has become so pervasive that attempts to mitigate its destructiveness and to rationalize its activity tend naturally to produce more government, more elegant solutions to government. And we see this kind of accretion of government in order even to solve the problems of government. Third, technology is so powerful that it's now there to help out Mr. Fix-It of government. I mean, the government has much more powerful tools than it ever had. Finally, I have this worry. In my new book, Safety Net, which Professor Nash referred to, I argue that discontinuous shocks, bolts from the blue, like 9/11 or the Japanese nuclear meltdown or the Gulf of Mexico oil blowout, will become more numerous in the years ahead. This Knightian risk, the risk that the economist Frank Knight pointed out that we were all kind of missing, the kinds of risks that you can't really even conceive of in many cases, that kind of risk is rising, mainly because of technology. And the response to such crises is always more government. And after the crisis passes, government accretion remains, as Robert Higgs showed so well in Crisis and Leviathan. And this may be the age of Crisis and Leviathan. The bright spot, however, is the public will. And let's not underestimate it. In the response to the 2008-2009 recession, Nicolas Sarkozy, president of France, and I guess the kind of the global leader of progressivism, gloated that the crisis, 2008-2009 recession, signaled the end of the, quote, illusion of public, that is to say government, impotence, and, quote, the return of the state. He was happy about that. And he was right, but only briefly. Since 2010, a surprising reversal has occurred, at least in public opinion, evidence in the congressional elections just passed, and Americans have concluded that Mr. Fix-It has failed to fix it, and more government has not worked. Now, while the crisis may have puffed up the Leviathan a bit with measures like Dodd-Frank and certainly Obamacare, there has been a strong public reaction. Where will it lead? We don't really know for now. But I'm encouraged. Finally, solving problems without government. How? Well, first and foremost is the intellectual work that you are doing. We have to push back against progressivism and teach a new generation of Americans why it doesn't work and why freedom and conservatism do. But second in our work, we have to resist the temptation, the impulse to big government solutions. And this is one of the guiding ideas behind the George W. Bush Institute. Over the past half century, think tanks have helped transform conservative ideas into important public policy. The work of the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, the Hoover Institution, and many others was essential in producing tax rate reductions, deregulations, and effective national security policy to counter communism and the surge in Iraq. In conceiving the George W. Bush Institute, we decided on a slightly different approach. We want to focus on specific projects that achieve practical and measurable results rather on proposals that require the assent of Washington to become reality. And our model goes like this. Assemble a team of researchers and on-the-ground practitioner partners. Find solutions. Work with partners to put the solutions into practice. Evaluate the results. Make mid-course corrections and evaluate again. An example of this is a project that we launched in September in the area of education reform. How to boost student achievement. And we decided that a key leverage point was school leadership, not by focusing on America's 4 million teachers, that may be a completely lost cause, but on the 130,000 principals in public and private schools. And the objective of the Alliance to Reform Education and Leadership, as we call it, is to change the paradigm by which principals are selected, trained, evaluated, and empowered. And how do we do that? Well, by working with partners to produce a new crop of principals, to place them in schools and examine the achievement of students in those schools compared with schools led by principals that don't go through our program. AREL was conceived and planned by a group of Bush Institute fellows led by Jim Guthrie, a former Vanderbilt professor. At the start of the research and planning process, Guthrie brought partners together. And those partners, yes, include school districts. We decided from the start that we would work with what Milton Friedman called government schools. We feel that ultimately the answer is competitive schools, but that's 20 or 30 years away. So school districts, education and business schools, corporate experts in human resources from companies like two of our stellar local businesses, Southwest Airlines and AT&T, and nonprofit organizations like Teach for America to find the best way to get results. We are not proposing a bill for Congress to pass. While the traditional think tank model has accomplished a great deal and will continue to accomplish a great deal, and we will deploy it in some cases as well. We believe that this more results-oriented model is particularly suited to the 21st century for several reasons. One, the ability of government to produce effective change, if it ever had an ability, is becoming more and more limited, both by political stalemate and a muscle-bound bureaucracy. And frankly, we've had enough of progressivism. So forget about government solving anything. Second, private sector institutions are becoming more skillful at social entrepreneurship. And finally, foundations and wealthy individuals are increasingly deploying large sums and demanding an explicit return on their investment. And we have no illusions about the course that we've charted. It requires a high degree of strategic planning, of intense management and coordination with a diverse set of partners, and discipline counts. We've limited ourselves to four areas of engagement, although they're quite broad: education reform, global health, human freedom, and economic growth. This structure would collapse if it weren't built on a foundation of conservative values. And we draw our inspiration from principles that have guided President Bush throughout his career. Freedom is universal. Leaders must be held accountable. Markets are the best managers of resources, and to whom much is given, much is required. We're trying to resist reflexively begging government for solutions. It's not always easy, but we're trying. And I think this is a message I'd like to convey to you today. But the question is, can we win? Can the people in this room ultimately triumph? And I know that 2 years ago at the Philadelphia Society meeting, national meeting, Professor Ryan declared that the conservative movement was in Chapter 11. I'm not sure that's so true today, after the failure of the progressive experiment of 2009 and 2010. But just remember that we cannot only be defensive. As Hayek wrote in 1960, the tug of war between progressives and conservatives can only affect the speed, not the direction, of contemporary developments. If we only go on the defensive, we will lose. Our job, as Hayek said, is to free the process of spontaneous growth from the obstacles and encumbrances that human folly has erected. I don't think there's any better way to say it. This project of freedom is not limited only to our own country. If freedom, as President Bush has said, is universal, then this project is global, is universal. It's time today to embark on an endeavor that could not be more important. This is our project. Thank you very much for listening.